Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record permanently archived at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do chapters 19 and 20 from Mike Smith's novel, The Eradicator, 2024. Let's get right to it. Chapter 19, Garden and Jungle. The Eradicator, Chapter 19, Garden and Jungle. The pilot had just finished his walk around when Jake and Chad got out of their car. He introduced himself and asked Chad, "May I have your firearm and ammunition, sir?" Chad warily gave him the .44 Magnum and ammo. The pilot took these to a fast parcel box, which he had prepared, and packed the gun and ammo in it. Then he handed the box to another man who was waiting and who then drove away with it. "Just a security precaution, sir. Dale's orders," the pilot explained to Chad. "Security?" "Well," the pilot laughed, his mouth widening under his beard, "do you think you can smuggle arms through an airport?" "We'll get it back at the hotel, probably," Jake said. They boarded the plane, a six-seater. It made several layovers for fuel on the way to Israel. Jake and Chad sat at the very back, Jake looking as if he were studying the books, Chad looking across the aisle at the window. "Remember our new names," Jake had told him after they took off. "I'm Slum Gurion, you're Ben Hess," Chad cut in. "I won't forget." "I forget that you're the one who's operationally experienced, not me." "No problem. You'll be my official assistant, maybe even in the lab, so familiarize yourself with this." Jake tapped one of the books with his finger, especially pages 193 and 194. He handed the book to Chad, who found there another slip of paper with a secret note. This one read, "Dale is still recording us. We can talk freely after we leave the plane." Chad flipped the paper over and pretended to write study notes on the back. Then he put the paper in his pocket and handed the book back. Their approach to TLV took them over brown desert country, then over white buildings that looked like sepulchers from this height. The plane touched down smoothly on the tire-blacked runway 12 and taxied to a remote stand. After Jake and Chad stepped onto the hot asphalt and said goodbye to the pilot, Chad said, "What I don't understand is, if they are making a bioweapon and you confirm it, what will we do about it?" Jake answered, "What could we do?" Chad said, "Kill them all." "You better take it easy, Mr. Bingham." A shuttle bus took them to Terminal 3. They printed their border control clearance cards at a kiosk there. Then a plainclothes security cop stopped Chad. "What is your name and why are you visiting Israel?" "Ben Hess. I'm a bodyguard for my employer," Chad answered and pointed to Jake. "Open your bag." Chad complied. The cop searched the bag thoroughly, throwing its contents on the floor. "Were you in a conflict?" "The Iran War." "You're an American?" "Yes, sir." By this time, another plainclothes cop arrived and interrogated Jake, too, asking mostly the same questions and searching his bag. "Where are you going?" cops wanted to know. Jake answered, "Hotel Golda. Those papers are our reservations." "You come here to work? Have you a work visa?" "Yes, here it is," Jake said and reached in his pocket. When Chad did the same, the cop stopped him and said, "Take your hand out of your pocket." A cop got the work visa from Chad's pocket and examined it. "What is your name?" "I told you, Ben Hess." "Where are you from in America?" "Hempstead, New York." "You're Jewish?" Chad shook his head. "No." "Don't shake your head. Yes or no?" "No." The other cop handed Jake's work visa and hotel reservation back to him. "What will you do for the Elie Wiesel Medical Center?" Jake corrected him sharply. "Elie Wiesel Medical Research Center." "What work will you do there?" "I'm a scientist. A visa tells you that information." The guard gave back the visa to Jake without looking at it again and told him to move on. "Wait for your companion at border control." Jake looked at Chad with a shrug of, "Oh well," in his eyes and left. They took Chad into a small private interrogation room and made him remove his prosthetic limbs, which they sent specially for x-raying. Meanwhile, he had to answer all the same questions again, this time for new interrogators. It took an hour, but they let him go. They gave him only a minute to reattach his limbs. As he walked to the border control to find Jake, several security personnel, not in plain clothes, watched him. "Well, Mr. Hess?" Jake asked him wryly. Chad shrugged. Neither had a problem at border control. They proceeded to customs and then left the airport. Even though both options were cheaper, they didn't want to go to Tel Aviv by charute or train. Given their professional profile, paying for a taxi looked less suspicious. $100 for a 12-mile ride northwest. But no taxis were waiting. Suddenly, a taxi pulled up seemingly out of nowhere, and the driver blasted his horn. A smiling young Israeli was driving. He was pale, dark-eyed, and clean-shaven except for a faint 5 o'clock shadow that seemed endemic. He called out, "No worries, I'll take you. Tel Aviv?" Jake and Chad piled in the back seat. As the driver pulled away, he said, "I'm Noah Cohn. What are your names, please?" His energetic friendliness marked him off from the other Israelis they'd seen so far, who had the personalities of dead fish, vulgarians, or pashas. After Jake answered his question, Noah wanted to know, "How did you like Natbag? Any problems with border control?" "Natbag? I'm sorry, it's our name for our airport." "There were no problems." Noah discussed the Iran war with Chad as they made their way into the city on Highway 1. The trip took only 20 minutes. Noah careered through the streets all the time, continuing the quiz. "Where in America did they come from? Why did they come to Israel? Who employed them? What work would they do?" As if suddenly inspired, he said, "I can help you. I can be your driver." "It isn't necessary," said Jake. "You don't want me to be your driver. We can make do ourselves, thank you." "I'm a bad driver? You think I don't know how to drive a car?" "You're doing fine," Jake reassured him. "We'll consider it, but we might make other arrangements." "Whatever you say, sir." They pulled up to Hotel Golda, G-O-L-D-A, a sort of gleaming dump, new but squatty. Noah hastened to carry their luggage in. He even accompanied them to the check-in desk and took the luggage up to their suite on the third floor as his taxi stood running in the street. "Very nice suite," Noah observed. "Two bedrooms." Noah refused when Jake tried to pay him. "Pay it next time." Jake insisted that he take the cash now. Noah put it in his pocket and he then left, but not without first giving them his business card. After he was gone, Jake joked, "Well, that's service." "I don't like that guy," Chad said. The phone rang. Jake and Chad looked at each other and Jake picked up the receiver. "Hello?" It was Dale. "Hello, friends. Thank you. How was your trip?" "Fine," Jake replied. "This conversation is a very special occasion. Do you understand what I mean?" Jake understood. Dale meant that the hotel phone was probably bugged. Dale's concern over this was ironic, since he was a bugger himself. "It's very special for us, too," Jake said. "All's well here. Good luck in your new job, friend," said Dale. "Ta." "Was that Dale?" Chad asked after Jake hung up. They heard a knock at the door. They looked at each other silently again, and Chad answered it. Noah stood there, holding something behind his back. "I told you I could be helpful. I have something for you." "What is it?" Chad wanted to know. Noah gave it to him, a familiar-looking package. "It was waiting for you at the front desk. I took the liberty of bringing it up here." Noah smiled. "Call me and I'll drive you again or help you in other ways. Shalom." He left again. Chad brought the package into the room and opened it up in front of Jake. It was the .44 Magnum and ammo. They didn't see Noah confer with three IDF soldiers after he reached the street. Few people saw or cared that he commanded one of the soldiers to drive the taxiway for him and then slid into an IDF vehicle along with the others. So some sort of military or military intelligence or something. "I'll try to get you in a scene break or paragraph break. I'll try to get you in as my lab assistant." "Be careful, sir," Chad said. Jake left the hotel and reached the morning street. He was about to look for a taxi when Noah honked his horn. Jake had no choice. He climbed into Noah's taxi. "I told you I can be helpful," Noah smiled. "You're unusually helpful." "Just after my business, Mr. May I call you Slum instead?" "Sure." As they sped to the Elie Wiesel Medical Research Center, Jake noticed no great apes on the sidewalks. In fact, Israel had no great apes anywhere. That made Jake feel transported into the past, a cleaner, better past. Nevertheless, he tensed up when Noah parked at the center. He had a tough interview ahead, he thought, but he knew what to say. And the ID and background story which Dale provided him were perfect, as far as he could see. Soon enough, he sat down with the center's head scientist, Faisal Hurwitz. Hurwitz possessed the most paranoid eyes Jake had ever seen. "We must clear up a little matter, Dr. Gurian. Interesting name, by the way." "No relation," Jake joked. Hurwitz's eyes were on him like a shot. "I wouldn't expect there to be. No, I mean the matter of your friend, Mr. Sass. He's my lab assistant." If that's misspelling or what, Hess or Sass, should be Hess. "He told the airport that he's your bodyguard. Which is he?" "Well, both." "Why do you need a bodyguard?" "Don't we all?" Hurwitz sighed. "You need no bodyguard and no assistant. You can open up to me. Is he your partner?" "What? You know, lover." Jake shrugged. "All right, yes, he's my partner. I didn't know how you'd feel about that." "Mr. Gurian, can I call you Dr. G? I don't like using that name in connection with you. Your relationship with Mr. Sass actually makes me feel sure of you." Then Hurwitz added reproachfully, "You came highly recommended." "I apologize for the understanding, Dr. Hurwitz." Hurwitz made a little shrug. "It's easier to ask forgiveness than permission. Don't apologize." He sat up in his chair. "So look at these." Hurwitz pulled out manila folders containing some kind of propaganda material. Jake examined this material when Hurwitz spread it out in front of him. One flyer, or mock-up of a flyer, read, "One species, the human species." It showed side-by-side images of a gorilla male's face and a human woman's face. Another read, "We are all one," and compared x-rays of a human woman and a gorilla male, as if all beings with skeletons were the same thing. He heard Hurwitz's voice explaining, "This was even promoted for a while for the jungle, but..." Jake frowned. "The jungle? I mean the world outside. We're the garden, you know." Or the chapter titled Garden and Jungle. So garden is Israel. Jungle is the Goyim world. "I mean the world outside. We are the garden, you know." Hurwitz pointed to the flyers. "So this is what you're proposing to work on?" Jake nodded, "Yes." "Chromosome fusing." Jake nodded again. "Interesting. Explain it to me." Jake explained the proposal for human-ape interbreeding, methodically meeting Hurwitz's objections. At last, Hurwitz cut him off with a gentle smile. "We'll put you to work immediately, Dr. G." End chapter 19. Chapter 20. "There is no place for humanity here." Chapter 20. "There's no place for humanity here." Jake met almost everyone at the center. Dead fish described the personality type of most. Only one, Gurwitz, called baby by the others, was different. Not Hurwitz, but Gurwitz. An overly warm, roly-poly type, he nevertheless took an instant dislike to Jake, refusing even to look at his face. Jake thought that he had better beware of baby, but it dawned on him that the dislike was instinctual, not specific. Baby didn't know anything. He just had an instinctive aversion, sensing that Jake is not his kind, despite his name. They took him through the labs of the section where he would work. The equipment met with his approval. It was all world class. As he knew, Israel made most genetics equipment. His colleagues, taken off other work to assist him in the project, were Uda Kiev and Tava Efrat, both females, but superficially different from each other. Uda stood tall and willowy, with a soft, wispy voice and a kind face, which looked like a puffy oval. Tava was short and looked smooth and hard, like a ladybug. Her jet-black perm contrasted Uda's straw-colored tresses. He outlined his research objective to them. Uda had a few slightly querulous questions, easily answered. Tava said nothing. They went to work, pulling the right papers and preparing the necessary samples. Meanwhile, he began the real work. Flip on to 158. Chan had nothing to do except wait for Jake to return, so he agreed when Noah showed up and offered to give him a tour of the city for a few shekels. Chan exchanged the money in the lobby. Noah explained the sights he was showing. These didn't stand out on their own. Chan saw clearly only the Azrieli Sarona Tower and a couple others in the urban bustle. Tel Aviv, Noah said in a confidential tone, has one of the largest gay communities in the world. We're very accepting of gay men. Really, Chad said. You don't have to feel ashamed here. You think I'm a queer? One of Noah's eyebrows made a small check mark. You aren't? Chad asked, do I owe you more? No, then I'll walk from here. I didn't mean to offend you, sir. I'm sorry. Noah parked the taxi and Chad got out. Chad definitely didn't like Noah now. More important, he didn't trust him. That Noah, for some reason, assumed he was a homosexual made him shake his head. He forgot it as he looked at the street-level sights, walking among outdoor cafes, open-air markets, dogs, and people. Half the people moved in groups like tourists. He liked the cleanliness of the streets, the efficiency of the light rail trains, and the total absence of apes. But the people had something foreign or bad about them. They were twitchy with selfishness and paranoid hostility, only partly caked over by a cloddish hauteur. He had reached a less busy area when a flood of Orthodox children overtook him. Twitchy with selfishness and paranoid hostility, only partly caked over by a cloddish hauteur. He had reached a less busy area when a flood of Orthodox children overtook him. Their peyotes swinging, they punched his arms and retreated. Then they came back to punch again and also to kick his good leg. Nazi, one boy cried. The rest took up the cry. Nazi, Nazi. He felt something wet in his face. They were spitting on him. Apparently his blondish hair or something about the cowboy swagger he had to perform in order to walk with a prosthetic leg triggered them. Little bitty, nasty Jew larvae, Jew piranha, little baby piranha Jews. You can picture them, how disgusting they are. He felt like explaining that he wasn't a Nazi. He wanted to tell them that he fought in the Iran war on the side of the U.S. and Israel. And he wondered why he ought to tell such creatures anything, and didn't. He lost them by reaching a fairly crowded light rail platform. Scene shift. Jake felt energized. He jumped out of the taxi, not Noah's, in the evening air, just in front of the hotel. He looked up at its sign. The sign glowed phosphorescently golden. Hotel Golda. He felt great because he had worked all day at his vocation. He saw Chad in the lobby. What are you doing down here?
Just hanging out, sir.
They went up to the suite and Jake told Chad about the center and then said, they won't accept any assistant. You'll have to stay here as my bodyguard.
I told them that at the airport.
Right. Jake felt too keyed up to go to sleep immediately. He spent half the night in the suite's common area, working on the laptop and on large notebooks he had brought with him. In the morning, he knocked on Chad's bedroom door.
Come in, Chad said.
Opening the door, Jake found Chad doing target practice using homemade paper targets and no bullets. The only sound was the click of the trigger. More than a dozen targets hung on the walls.
How do you know if you hit them? Jake quipped.
I know. I'll find out today about the bioweapon Dale said they're making. Without looking at him, Chad asked, what time do you expect to return tonight?
On 160.
About 8 o'clock. Click was the only response. Noah's taxi waited for Jake. Jake sighed in exasperation and jumped in.
Good morning, Mr. Slum. You look excited this morning. Your work pleases you?
It does.
That's good.
Noah, do you believe in population reduction?
Noah shrugged and then grinned.
Depends which population.
I mean, do you believe it would help the world?
There are such things as necessary massacres. We were taught this in school.
Yes, Jake said, remembering Gaza.
That isn't the correct name, Mr. Slum.
Jake leaned forward. I asked because my dream is to pacify great apes so that they don't continue massacring people. What do you think?
I don't know. I can't comment.
At the center, Jake greeted Uta. She looked especially attentive and asked him if something were bothering him.
Jake replied, my taxi driver talked about necessary massacres.
You find it an upsetting topic of discussion?
What's your opinion?
She made a chuckle and a little shrug.
I lived in the former settlements. We didn't reclaim Israel without wiping out the enemy.
Jake nodded. The motherland, Uta went on, the kind of lines her face rang into their opposite, requires the removal of the nations, the Goyim.
You mean eradication?
What else can one do with mortal enemies?
Jake nodded again. Do you have the SV-40 prepared?
Uta said, "Of course, Dr. Gurian," and began work. Jake spent the rest of the day researching the center's bioweapon program, which did exist. The discovery wasn't a great surprise to him. What sent a chill up his back was that the program used gain-of-function research on smallpox. He doubted that such a monstrous bioweapon would actually work. Turbo-boosted smallpox would kill everyone indiscriminately, assuming the center could even create it in the first place. He read the reams of papers on it. They were just words, vague verbiage looping in great self-referential circles, verbal diarrhea, as his childhood friends in Chatsworth might have called it. But behind the ramshackle reasoning, the bioweapon looked plausible enough for him to keep poking into it. No one stopped him from doing this, although it was unrelated to his job. He moved freely about the center. He thought Hurwitz gave him liberty to explore every aspect of the center's work as an important intellectual stimulant to his own work. He suspected that the scientist involved in the bioweapon project depended at bottom on words to change the world. He didn't think they could do effective science. He formed this opinion of them after hearing them say they were taking great precautions to ensure that the bioweapon didn't also harm them. It sounded like an excuse because it shouldn't harm them. They should be DNA immune. In a friendly request to assist their work, he asked their permission to pull their DNA profiles. He told them he would double-check their immunity tolerance to any gain of function of smallpox. Most said okay. The center kept a DNA profile on everyone there except him, but since his work didn't involve bioweapons, that was natural. What he found confirmed the worst. Jews had immunity to the bioweapon. If the bioweapon worked, it would kill all non-Jews. All non-Jews. If the bioweapon worked, it would kill all non-Jews. Maybe it wouldn't work. After all, smallpox was often uncooperative, and pandemic spread remained unpredictable because, as he and every other serious geneticist knew, germ theory had holes in it. But why did the Jews have DNA immunity? Because, as he found, they were a different species. He had never looked at that before. It never occurred to him to. Old studies had established a clear genetic difference or distance between Jews in Europe and Europeans, and everyone knew that many diseases, especially prevalent in Jews, had clear genetic markers, but the work of identifying the Yudisha Tupus Jewish type, the unique racial fingerprint of Jews, had fallen to Israeli geneticists. What Jake found studying their material, which astonished him with its bracing clarity, so unlike the work on the bioweapon, was that this fingerprint comported with species difference. This finding was a discovery on the same level as his earlier breakthrough, remember fusing chimp-human, finding their similarity point. And as he knew, the terms race, population, clime, and other similar ones are euphemistic when used interchangeably, and the same sort of fudging applies to race and species. A great deal of squinting, deliberate ambiguity, and simple disagreement had always complicated these two ideas. And he knew that every species succeeds by eliminating its competition in the same ecosystem. He thought of the Cro-Magnons supplanting Neanderthals, often by massacre. As he told Grote, nature applies the law of the jungle to everything. The only question is, which species will be apex predator in a given ecosystem? The Jews had managed to survive and come out on top of hominins. That much was clear. Genetically intact for at least 6,000 years and probably much longer than that, they were a throwback. Their species had lasted by segregating itself when possible, acting as chameleons when necessary, and sticking together, united in the instinct to eliminate species competitors, especially humans. The tribe, this atavistic species, had proceeded cleverly. They hacked the minds of Homo sapiens, got them to fight and kill each other, and economically and culturally lived as parasites on the survivors, who survived only temporarily. He hadn't read anything about the genetics in Dale's library since he didn't need to, and since the material was poor anyway. Instead, he read everything he could find there about Jews, material which, that library had a lot of, favorable and unfavorable alike, understandably given Dale's personal history. Science, history, experience, everything was lining up for him. It only confirmed what he had already concluded. He returned to his section of the center and went through the motions of working on his project. Late in the day, he answered a knock on the door of the little room where he analyzed samples. It was an unfamiliar, rough-looking young man with a companion, a smallish woman. "Come with us, doctor. We have a few questions." "Don't interrupt me. See Dr. Hurwitz first." "Dr. Hurwitz requested this, sir." Jake shrugged and went along with them. They took him down the hallway to a bare, windowless room the size of a walk-in closet. It contained two chairs. A man and woman left him there to wait. Soon a woman came in and demanded his arm. She drew blood. He asked what for, but she didn't answer. She left. He guessed that they were going to analyze his DNA. That wasn't good. If they did that, they would learn his true identity. The pair reappeared. "We're waiting for your DNA results. You'll have to answer a few questions in the meantime," the man told him. "Answer truthfully," the woman said in a flat voice. "Why aren't you working on your project?" "I am," Jake replied. "No, you aren't. You're working on the bioweapon project." "What do you mean?" "You're spending a lot of time on it." "It fascinates me." The man didn't smile. "What is this desire you said you have to pacify great apes?" Jake felt shocked. Obviously, Noah had ratted him out. He had never mentioned ape pacification to anyone else except Chad, and Chad wouldn't betray him. He shrugged and said, "Everyone wants peace. You asked for SV-40 samples. That has nothing to do with great apes, does it?" Jake just looked at him. "Simian virus 40 is a polyoma virus found in monkeys," the man went on. "Simian virus 40, a polyoma virus found in monkeys." Jake thought to dispute him, but grasped that his colleagues had informed this man and that they knew SV-40 was a dodge. The man appeared a little exasperated now, as if he were angry. "Did you make a mistake, or is your real aim something else?" Jake asked evenly, "What do you mean?" "Do you aim at something other than inbreeding humans and great apes, and something other than pacification of great apes as well?" "No." The door opened and another man came in, softer, but somehow more thuggish than the first man. His name is Jake McAllister, American wanted for humanism. The three left the room immediately. Jack tried the door. It was locked from the outside. At length, the door opened and three different men entered, one carrying a greasy briefcase, another bulked large in his black tracksuit, and the third had two outstanding features, a buck-toothed, lopsided, broken grin of malice and black eyes refulgent in sadism. Jake didn't know where he was for a second. The sweatsuit man had punched him in the face. Before Jake recovered his bearings, the man had tied him to the chair. The grinner was saying, "What are you up to? Who do you work for? What are you up to?" The tracksuit man punched him again. Jake couldn't answer even if he wanted to. He must have passed out. Next thing he knew, Grinner had him by the throat on the floor. How he got out of the chair situation and into a kneeling position on the floor, Jake couldn't even guess. Grinner was hissing, "What are you up to? Who do you work for? What are you up to? You thought you could fool us?" Grinner let go of Jake's throat and everything became clear in the sudden rush of returning oxygen. They were torturing him, supposedly for information, but without letting him answer. Grinner stood over Jake and got it louder, a silhouetted figure trembling with, was it pleasure? Yes, pleasure. Jake could understand some of what he screamed. 6 million! 6 million, you killed, you dogs! Steam chambers opened the pores of us to let the gas in better. Electric floors gave us the dance of death. Eagles and bears in cages tore at us. Masturbation machines jerked us to death. You made lampshades out of our skin. You shrank our heads. You pumped gas in our anus. Your pedal-driven brain-bashing machine carved our heads in. You melted us into soaps to use in your fine hair. You made us ride roller coasters into flames. We know you, and we know what we will do to you. With the last piece of his mind that he possessed before passing out again, Jake knew their real motive for delaying the bioweapon. Sadism. They enjoyed torturing the nations with lies or with apes, as Dale said to him long ago, or with anything at all. And that's the end of this segment. Chapters 19 and 20, getting real dramatic. We got four chapters left, two sessions left. Jake's been found out, and now they're torturing him and getting off on it, as Jews absolutely do. I've been Alex Linder, reading to you out of Mike Smith's 2024 novel, The Eradicator, permanently archived in our audio section at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.